Tonight on Arena, Druid's new production of The Seagull in the evocative setting of Coole Park with Game of Thrones star Jack Gleeson and Mark Ronson's Watch the Sound, a new TV series on the business of music production. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. 40 years ago, Thomas Kilroy's adaptation of Chekhov's classic play The Seagull premiered at the Royal Court in London with a cast that included T.P. McKenna, Harriet Walter and Alan Rickman. Kilroy's version of the tragic comedy moved the setting from a country estate in provincial Russia to the west of Ireland. Druid Theatre Company is about to stage it outdoors at Coole Park, Lady Gregory's home in County Galway. Absolutely perfect setting for this play. Eileen Walsh plays fading actress Isabel Desmond. Jack Gleeson, best known to many as the villainous Joffrey in Game of Thrones, is her lonely, desperate son Constantine. Isabel and Constantine have swapped their usual London base for a summer in Ireland with Isabel's brother Peter, played by Pasco Hogan, and there's a lot of disappointment in the air. Delighted to have Gary Hines and Gleeson join me on the programme this evening. I believe this is a play, Gary, that has been, you say that it's been in your back pocket literally for years and that you've been dying to put it on.
Absolutely. I mean, my copy of it is tattered. It's the original publication from the Royal Court production in 1981. And obviously with its setting in Galway and knowing Tom Kilroy as I do, I've long wanted an opportunity to do it. For some reason or other, the combination of Coole Park and the circumstances and all these came together to finally, it seemed just exactly the right thing to do.
You had been doing productions in Coole Park in recent times, obviously as much as anything because of COVID, but this is, it's That's just right. Like the perfect setting for this play, given what Kilroy did to the Chekhov setting.
Well, absolutely. I mean, what this is, we're used to versions of Chekhov in the Irish dialect, if you like, if I can call it that, like Friel and Tom Murphy, The Cherry Orchard, which we did last year. But in this case, Tom Kilroy has totally kind of transplanted the play to Ireland. And he found an extraordinary relationship between the play, its setting in Russia in the 1890s, and the particular setting in Ireland of the 1880s. And it's an extraordinary, inspired, I think, version of Chekhov. Yeah, so it's wonderful to have the opportunity.
So much that resonates historically with what was happening in Ireland at that time, in terms of, I suppose, the collapse of the aristocracy and these big houses that were falling into rack and ruin, and previously rich families suddenly in dire straits and in real difficulty, but trying to maintain the life that they previously had.
They're beginning to realise, I mean, Tom actually set it 10 years earlier than the 1890s Chekhov play, because there's rumblings on the horizon. Things aren't beginning to break apart yet. But there is a sense that there is a whole class whose future suddenly seems in jeopardy, not as secure as once it was.
Yeah, and that is kind of the theme that he mines so well in the play, and that was there.
So brilliantly.
Really brilliantly done. Let me turn to Jack then, to Jack Gleeson and the character of Constantine. I suppose for any young actor, Jack, the character of Constantine in The Seagull is a great challenge in any version. Were you aware or were you familiar with other versions of the play before you got to read this Thomas Kilroy version?
Not particularly, no. This was probably the first version that I read all the way through. I might have seen snippets of other versions online or on TV, but no, this was the first one that I came into intimate contact with. Okay. And as Gary was saying, it's a beautifully adapted text, and yeah, the part of Constantine, yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's a total dream role, so I'm over the moon.
Yeah, he's the son of he's a writer, and I'm certainly very interested in theatre himself, but he's the son of a famous actress, the Isabel character played by Eileen Walsh, and that family dynamic is hugely important in the role. What's the attraction for you as an actor for this, for to play Constantine?
Geez, that's a good question. I think there's a sense in which he's by no means a two-dimensional person. Mm. Even in the same scene, he can switch. Even in the same sentence, he can switch. In the same moment, between different states of being, and to find the subtlety in such a well-written character is just a great challenge. Mm. And I applaud Gary for putting up with me for so long, holding my hand through the process. But just every day there's a new discovery in the nuance of the character, and it's all there in the script itself. So it's just about letting the script talk as much as possible.
Obviously, people will know you from Joffrey and from Game of Thrones, who was pretty nasty bit of work, if you don't mind my saying. So, yeah. The chance to do theatre like this is how important is that to you after being involved in such a phenomenal project as Game of Thrones was, and worldwide success.
I think it's more important. I mean, not to be a suck up, but I think it's more important to be working with Druid than anything else. I mean, it's just been such a delight from day one. So I think it's always good. Most actors would hopefully agree that it's good to have a mixture of both screen and stage. Just because it extends different muscles. But my muscles are very well looked after with Druid, and that's the dream.
Yeah, well, if anybody's going to extend your acting muscles, it's Gary Hines, if I have any, if I know anything about her. But I guess, Gary, obviously there is from the production side of things, it's great to have somebody with Jack's profile involved in the piece, but you wouldn't have cast him if you didn't think he could play the part, no matter what fame he had.
Absolutely not, no. Jack is a very talented young man, and we're very fortunate. It's wonderful doing something like the Siegel, because you have generations of actors. So we have established actors like Marie Mullen and Marty Ray, Brian Doherty, but we also have a bunch of young actors all playing significant roles. There's absolutely no small role in Chekhov, and that includes Jack. So it's wonderful to have the diversity of talents and ages and perceptions of Chekhov working in the room, discovering him anew as the weeks go by.
It's vitally important to the play, of course, is that character of Isabel, as she is in this version from Thomas Kilroy. I'll ask Jack this, the relationship, Jack, between the mother and son here. It's a difficult one to pin down.
It's again, there are discoveries every day. Between myself and Eileen, which is, it's just been such a joy to work with her, because she's so open into exploring and that sort of thing. If I were to pin it down, it's quite a sad relationship. I don't think either of them are very happy in the relationship from Constantine's point of view. He's desperately seeking a maternal touch, and maybe from Isabel's point of view, she's also, saddens her that she can't connect with her son. And then there's also jealousy and anger, and it's a whole mess of things. And I don't think either of them really get a grasp on it so well.
Yeah, and what about, obviously you're well used to people having seeing you on screen in terms of Games of Thrones, but this is a different prospect, I presume. Will family be able to travel? I know we've all these COVID things to think about, but will family get up to see this and performing in front of a live audience? Very different experience from behind the camera, I would have thought.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, I certainly did a lot of stage work when I was a lot younger. So they're well used to seeing me playing, tree number two on the left in the local community centre. They're thrilled. They're really excited. And yeah, I think my sisters and my parents are going to be able to come up.
So yeah, things seem to be opening up at this stage, Gary, and perhaps we're getting back to a situation where we might actually be able to be in the theatre soon with people sitting in front of us.
Well, I absolutely hope so. And I think it's very important that we do move faster than we appear to be moving. I don't mean faster in terms of COVID, but it's you know, in the context, restaurants are opening up, bars and so on and so forth. And I think it's very important now that the government pay attention to the theatre and to the arts generally, and, you know, allow us to get back to our audiences in a live way, and get back to doing what we absolutely need to do, which is having the actors and the audience all together in the one space. So we're hoping that that's going to happen very soon.
A bit like the casting of Jack, though, as I said, if he couldn't play the part, he wouldn't be there no matter what television or film exposure he had had previous to this. Yeah. The Cool Park aspect, the Cool Park aspect of things is kind of a happy accident in that respect as well.
Yes, I mean, when we were, we originally had, before COVID, we had scheduled to do 11 one-act plays, and some of those plays were set indoors, and so we had to completely rethink the idea. And it became really about Lady Gregory, and if we were going to perform it somewhere, then obviously Cool Park, and we discovered Cool Park and the glory of Cool Park at that time, doing the Lady Gregory plays, and we wanted to get back there one way or the other. And so then the sort of, not coincidence, but if you like, Cool as probably one of the places Tom had in mind when he set the play in the west of Ireland, and our wanting to go back to Cool Park, and our need to engage with our audience in an outdoor setting until we can get back into a theatre, all these things came together in what I think is, for us, feels a very fortunate and magical combination.
Well, listen, it sounds very exciting. And I know the last time you were performing in Cool Park, travelling from this part of the country over to Galway wasn't possible. So I'm hoping this time it might just be possible to do that. But it is going to be available in a filmed version later in September, is that, yeah?
Yes, it will be filmed in the course of rehearsals and performances, and we will be making it available for the Galway Arts Festival later on. So people who can't actually get there, and unfortunately at the moment our tickets are sold out, but we do have a waiting list, we'll be able to see it online.
Right, well, that sounds great indeed. Thanks for speaking to us about that this evening. And indeed, Jack, best of luck to you in the performance of Constantine. I'm sure the parents may well remember tree number two from the left, but they'll be very excited, the family, to see the role of Constantine. Best of luck with it all, Jack.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That's Jack Gleeson playing the role of Constantine in that production of Tom Kilroy's adaptation of Chekhov's The Seagull. And as Gary Hines, director, was telling us, it opens at Cool Park, 10th of August, runs through until the 21st with previews from the 6th. Tickets all sold out there, but who knows, returns might come through. It will be available on demand from the 5th through to the 12th of September as part of the Galway International Arts Festival. And you can find out further details on druid.ie. Back in 2014, record producer Mark Ronson gave a TED talk discussing how sampling transformed music. Now he's set to expand on this theme in a new six-part documentary series, Watch the Sound. It'll be available on Apple TV+. The series explores music's intersection with artistry and technology, that's a quote, and features discussions with the likes of Paul McCartney, Questlove, Dave Grohl, Mike D from the Beastie Boys, Charlie XCX, and many more. Joining me this evening is Kate Brennan-Harding, who's been watching the series. Before we get into the series itself, Mark Ronson, we'll talk a bit about him. Household name as a record producer, not least because of his work with Amy Winehouse. He credits his career really to the very short amount of time he spent working with her.
Yeah, he does. Hi, Sean. Ronson is kind of fascinating because, like, he grew up in quite a salubrious environment. You know, his family was very wealthy, and he was born in England and moved to New York, and began his creative process and DJing in the hip hop scene in New York. But his meeting with Amy Winehouse seems to have caused such a huge reaction that it's gone on to influence every single thing he's touched, because she wanted to create a particular sound, you know, that doo-wop kind of Shangri-La sound. And he went off overnight, trying to figure out how to do that. They would wander around New York when she was recording Back to Black, and she was having difficulties kind of recording that album at the time. And obviously, you know, because rehab, and her parents had suggested she goes to rehab. So there was a lot of emotional turmoil going on for her there. But they spent 7 nights and 7 days wandering around, sort of discussing the album and recording it in 1 and 2 takes. And he, obviously, it's 10 years since her death. And he tweeted the other day, like, that he is saying that her genius is the reason that she has a career, or he has a career today. Yeah. So her influence is vast reaching and going across many genres.
Yeah. In fact, let's just stick with Amy Winehouse for the time being, because the way the series works is it kind of in each episode, it takes some kind of, if you like, record producing tool, like autotune in the first part, for example. In the third part of the series, isn't it? That's where we go into reverb.
It's reverb.
Yeah, which is where Amy Winehouse comes into play. And you could say, you know, Ronson himself talks about this, that in fact he loved the dry sound, no big echoes that you get with reverb. And it was Amy Winehouse that kind of opened his mind to the idea of reverb, using it.
Exactly, and bringing that in and like the level of emotion. So he talks about, you know, particularly wanting to get and convey, like Ronson has always said that if he can get to the soul of an artist, then he's winning. You know, he doesn't want to work with people unless he can get to the soul. And I guess Winehouse with reverb, like what she was talking about, the subject matter on Back to Black, is so deep and so emotional. And like it conveyed, obviously, what an amazing writer she was. And reverb, he gets together with the Dap Kings, who recorded the melodies for the album and everything. He adds reverb to everything. And this series is really kind of interesting because, as you said, it's split into 6 episodes. So you've got autotune, sampling, reverb, synthesizer, drum machines and distortion. Now, to anyone that isn't a music nerd, they'd be like, oh God, why would I watch this? But actually, it's fascinating because the sounds that we hear every single day and the sounds that make up particular eras are explored, and explored with this really kind of just curiosity. He's got such a curious mind around how sound is created. And like when we go back to the reverb episode, we're talking about he actually ends up in this disused oil container. And I loved it because this oil container is not just your ordinary oil container. These are in Scotland and they're bigger, like I think they're 3 or 4 times bigger than the biggest cathedrals in the world.
Yeah, so the reverb goes on forever.
Yeah, and he goes down and he's part of, there's a company that goes and actually specifically records and takes digital kind of samples of what the reverb would be so that then producers can use that to recreate that reverb.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's just, for whether you're nerdy or not, it's a really amazing, interesting episode to watch him go down into these oil containers to create this noise.
Yeah, because what he manages to do, he's a great communicator and he manages to demystify very technical things, because lots of the stuff around this is talking about high use of technology and very advanced and very, you know, up-to-the-minute technology. He talks about how you use that to an end rather than getting lost in the, you know, what button you press, if you like.
Yeah.
But let's just have a listen to him, because we'll get a sense of that communicative ability in the episode with Amy Winehouse. And he's talking about working with her on the track Back to Black, as you said, and how important reverb was for her sound.
And the most important thing.
And my tears dry, get on without my.
Put like quite a lot of reverb on everything there just to give it this epic loneliness. The idea of putting this ton of reverb over a voice, it's like as if you're watching a cartoon and saw a person in a room, and then the more you keep turning the reverb up, the room just keeps getting bigger till they look smaller.
I go back to us.
She'd been working on her album for a couple of years at that point, was like hit a wall. She was like, this is the sound of my record.
We only said
think about that moment. I'd never made anything that sounded that emotional and raw before. And it's like my career started then.
Yeah.
Sound matters. And there are all these tools that we use that make our favourite songs truly extraordinary.
That's the voice of Mark Ronson from the series Watch the Sound, a new series on Apple TV Plus. Kate Brennan-Harding has been watching it for us. And that's what I wanted to get across there, Kate, was this idea that, yes, he's talking about these very technical things, but even the way they give you the example of, you know, if you're watching a cartoon and you see there's a cartoon on the screen and they pull away from the little figure in the middle, and it perfectly illustrates what he's talking about in terms of sound and technicalities.
Completely. And that's what's so lovely about the visuals around this. And Apple TV, you know, have a rich kind of tone in terms of the cinematography of it. And it's like there's all these kind of new technologies that are used visually as well. Like there's times where Ronson, you know, when he's talking about, say, autotune, or he's talking about distortion, and he suddenly transforms into a pixelated image and disappears and goes off into the sound. You know, like it's a really fun way of disseminating the information, and really graspable, as you were saying. You know?
And the other thing is he starts with autotuning, which for many people, even if you know nothing about music, you hear the word autotune and you go, oh no, not that. Why are they doing that? This is just for people who can't sing. In fact, Ronson in the first episode of the series refers to it as the sound of cheating. But he has to change his mind.
He completely changes his mind. And to be honest, watching it for me, I mean, I knew and I know there's great ways of using autotune. But watching that episode was also me going, hang on a minute, I really need to let go of my my own agenda around it. Because it has, autotune is something that came about by accident. It is a tool that was used for Sonic, it was a guy, an engineer. A lot of physics science is used in this episode. But autotune came about by accident. So think about like Eiffel 65, you know, Blue Dabba Dee, that song. And then we've got Cher, obviously, who
let's listen to Cher and what Mark Ronson has to say about the number one from 1988, Believe. And
1998,
this is, yeah. Sorry, 1998, I beg your pardon. And this is where he's still a little bit dubious, and then he hears this.
Autotune is so like heavy on our vocal. It's the most futuristic thing ever, and it almost sounds even more futuristic and out of context. Like, what fucking year was this? 1998. I appreciate it a lot more than I did back then. Probably then I was like a music purist and was like, what is this shit? Like, and now I'm just hearing it and I'm just like, wait, Cher has come back from the past to warn us about the future? Like, what the hell is going on this record?
Yeah, and there he goes. He kind of admits, oh, right. So that's Mark Ronson, I should say, from the series Watch the Sound that Kate Brennan-Harding is talking about. Yeah, and as you said, Dr. Andy Hildebrand talks about, he invented the technology for autotune, which was all about fuel deposits deep underground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how that became...
keep going back to fuel and gas and oil, don't we?
But how he turned that into something that initially fixed bad, out-of-tune voices. But then what Ronson cleverly does in that first episode is he looks at how people started to use it on purpose.
Yeah, completely. Like Kanye West, uses it, 808 and Heartbreak. Like that is absolutely huge album. It's an iconic album. And Kanye is not a singer. And to use that, he was, you know, that album was all about the death of his mother and his grieving process and his own mindset. And Ronson reckons that if it wasn't for autotune, we wouldn't have had the melodies that live inside Kanye's head come out on that album. So, and Ronson also says, recently I read an interview where he was talking about having worked with Amy Winehouse and having seen how she conveyed emotion. He couldn't see or understand how autotune could in turn convey the emotion. But what Kanye did is actually completely bring himself down to this isolated state, this autotune state, this semi-robotic state. And in that, his feelings of despair come out much more so than if there was not autotune used on it.
Yeah, he keeps referring to sad robot sound.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's also this kind of thread throughout the entire series, where we're looking at how technology influences and changes music. And we're looking at, there's always a backlash. There's always, oh God, no, we don't want that. And that's going to change music in a bad way, and it's removing the human. And what he continuously does, weaving it very cleverly through the series, is to look at how technology progresses. There's a fear, there's a backlash, and then there's somebody who gets it and creates something magic with it. And I guess that's, you know, evolution of sound, isn't it? And it's like, so autotune is one of those things that has, I mean, he tries to autotune Lady Gaga's voice on Shallow, which obviously doesn't work because Shallow needs to be sung without autotune, and her voice is kind of perfect anyway. So he shows where it's not usable, but he shows it then as being this really unique other instrument, so to speak.
Yeah, and the sort of they're not talking heads, because a lot of the time they're either he turns himself into a guinea pig to be produced, or he's working with people he has worked with, like Charlie XCX. There are other really, you know, huge stars that have contributed to this series that he has worked with.
Well, Paul McCartney, I mean, you don't really, in my mind, get bigger than McCartney, do you know what I mean? And it's gorgeous because McCartney just is sort of, it's just two people who I think are still in wonder, you know, that lovely child state, and they just kind of just play and they're messing around and they're chatting. And McCartney's talking about how he started really getting interested in synthesizers. And he talks about how, you know, the rest of the Beatles are getting annoyed with him because he was trying to get particular sounds correct using, you know, very first Moog, which is one of the machines that has generated so many sounds, and so many bands have used that down through the decades.
And with the help of John Lennon's son, Sean, he puts a bit of auto-tune on Lennon's voice to see what that might do.
Yeah, and like Sean Lennon and Mark Ronson are actually childhood friends. So it's kind of like, it's a really intimate exploration of what music is. And like also throughout the series, we hear like Ronson at the age of three, his parents were often having big parties with lots of rock and roll stars because his stepdad is the founder of the band Foreigner. And he talks about at the age of three, coming into a room where maybe 50 people are, and he hears, he just goes straight over to the speaker because he's listening to the music and he just starts drumming. And some record producer looked at his parents and said, I think you need to get that boy a drum. And he, at the age of three, gets a drum kit. And so, you know, we're hearing how he has built music into his life, you know?
A drum kit at three.
I know.
That's parental love for sure. let's move on to episode two, where Public Enemy have play a big part here. It's all about sampling. And here's Ronson talking to Hank Shockley from Public Enemy about how they started using sampling on records from the second episode, as I say, of the series.
Back in the days, DJs used to play in the park. There would be a DJ in one corner, a DJ and another, and a DJ and another, and a DJ, and they will all play at the same time. It's the craziest thing that you ever want to go to, but I want to find that sweet spot, the area where I can hear all of them at the same time, because there's moments when the frequencies all mesh together and give you a totally new rhythm that you've never would have gotten by listening to any one of them directly. And so that right there is, I want to recreate that vibration sonically in the studio with the records.
I was 14 years old when Public Enemy dropped Fear of a Black Planet. The way those samples worked on top of each other had me mesmerized. And I would listen to that cassette every spare second in between class. In order to fight
the
power
campaign. The whole sampling thing started for us because we want to prove that you can take records and make new records. We were like a bunch of kids that people was thinking that we was non-musical because we didn't play an instrument, we didn't go to school, we didn't know how to read sheet music or any of that stuff, but we got a great ear. A lot of the Public Enemy design was based off of that type of energy.
Hank Shockley there from Public Enemy, speaking with Mark Ronson from the television series we're talking about tonight, Watch the Sound, Kate Brennan-Harding. Worth remarking just before we finish up on this, Kate, about the balanced representation of male and female artists in this. You've seen all six episodes, have you?
Watched all six episodes, really enjoyed, even episodes that I wouldn't, like the synthesizer and reverb episodes are my favourite because that sort of piles into the music, like disco, that I absolutely love. But what's gorgeous about this episode, and it's like, obviously, this is the way that I think TV and radio should be, that you don't remark on the fact that there's a gender balance, but there is a gender balance between artists, between the people that we talk about. In the synthesizer episode, there's, you know, huge praise for Wendy Carlos and Delia Derbyshire, who are two of the pioneers. Engineering women who invented synthesizers, and they didn't get enough credit and praise at the time. So it's really great to see that, and it's great to see Mark Ronson going, "Oh, I didn't know that," and he's learning as he goes along. You know,
and that's what's lovely about him. He's never afraid to say, "I didn't know that," and he's also not afraid to make a bit of an idiot out of himself the odd time.
Completely. And you know what's gorgeous as well? At the end of every single episode, he produces and makes a completely new song, an original song featuring the technology that they're discussing throughout the episode.
Yeah, it's great stuff indeed. Thanks so much for that. That's Kate Brennan Harding and Mark Ronson's Watch the Sound is the title of the series. It'll be available from this Friday on Apple TV Plus. And so to our Where Do I Begin slot, when we ask an expert or enthusiast to bring us into the work of an artist they love through three or four key works. Jimmy Cagney is the choice of Tony Tracy, who's going to reintroduce us to this giant of Hollywood. Tony, I think it's probably almost impossible for us to understand just how, or to grasp just how famous Cagney was in his day.
Yeah, and perhaps more than that, Sean, just how much he changed screen acting and how important he was to a new kind of cinema. I mean, it's probably worth reminding ourselves that James Cagney, you know, made his career, initial career as a young man in his 20s, as a dancer, as a hoofer, as he always described himself, on the New York stage. By the end of the 1920s, he was trying to get onto the stage, into the legitimate theatre and so on. And it was really only because Hollywood introduced sound in the early 1930s, as you know, beginning with the jazz singer in the 1920s, that they needed a new kind of star, a new kind of actor, and particularly an actor who could play these socially conscious roles in urban pictures. And it was really only because of that Cagney went west. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone west. And he brought to the screen a patois, a kind of a rhythm, and a persona and an energy that was completely new. And it was on account of that, really, that he became as fast a star as he did. And because Warner Brothers really, really needed him, his films became exceptionally popular. Yeah. And he made half of his career films in that first decade of it in the 1930s.
And we can claim at least 75% of them.
Well, that's it. Yeah, his four of his grandparents, one of them is Norwegian, although I think once you know that, he does look quite Norwegian.
There is a touch of that, yeah.
But three of his grandparents were Irish. I think it's interesting about Cagney's Irishness. He didn't have the same kind of sentimental relationship to it that his good friend Pat O'Brien, for instance, did, or even somebody like Spencer Tracy. He would occasionally describe himself as Irish, but that wasn't his main calling card. He was unusual in that regard. And even though I would say, I think I did a count of this once, and I think sort of 60% of his characters were in fact Irish.
Yeah.
But he didn't have that sentimentality about Irish Americanness that so many actors did.
Yeah, well, he may not have mentioned it too often, but we're certainly going to claim him as one of our own. You mentioned that we're in the early stages, really, of the talkies in the 1930s, Tony, and Public Enemy is the first piece that you've chosen for us. What specifically did Cagney lay out here? Because this would have been quite early on in his career, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. So from Public Enemy in your last piece to The Public Enemy here, which is really the place where this phrase gets introduced into American culture. So really, we wouldn't have Public Enemy without this film. So he's on stage in the early 1930s. He's seen by no one else except Al Jolson, who options a play he's in called A Sinner's Holiday. That goes out to Hollywood. It's a short quickie, and he plays a kind of urban, as I say, sort of not quite a gangster yet, but he's cast then again on account of the energy and the way he delivers dialogue in this film called The Public Enemy. But what's remarkable is he's cast in the supporting role. This is his third film. And a week into shooting, the director, William Wellman, who had made a great many silent films, but would make many sound films also, a week into shooting said, listen, we got to switch these roles. So he switched Cagney and his brother, played by Donald Cook, into respective roles. And Cagney took it on with absolute brio and energy and viciousness. But also he combines that with an incredible tenderness. And that combination of tenderness, particularly in relationship to the mother figure and the family around him, and raw aggression and violence, very famous in this film. There's a grapefruit scene, for instance. That was unique to Cagney, his ability to turn and change tenor and tone very quickly. So it's his third film and it makes him an instant star and he gets an instant a 7-year contract.
Yeah, and as you say, the mother-son relationship will come up again, probably more predominantly in the next film that we're going to speak about. But in the case of The Public Enemy, another thing that is established here is brotherly conflict is very often a theme in the characters and in the films he's in.
Yeah, so the thing about the Warner Brothers films that Cagney, you know, comes to stardom in the 1930s is they're basically social problem films. They're films that are wrestling with the Great Depression. That context is really, really crucial. And so the films are trying to have it both ways. They're trying to excite the audience and show this kind of deviation from the norm, and at the same time trying to analyse why this deviation happens. So it's playing it both ways, which, you know, it comes in the aftermath of the 20s where you have the gangster who kind of misinterprets the American dream of individualism, but against the context of federalism and the New Deal and so on. So very often these films play it both ways, and they often explore this kind of duality of individualism, usually with violence on the one hand, and also community, on the other hand, through a fraternal relationship. So you've often got a Cain and Abel brother situation. And very often in these films in the 1930s, those brothers are Irish. And so there's an extra dimension because it's explored in terms of ethnicity. The one brother who conforms and becomes a good American by going to night school and fighting in the war, in the case of The Public Enemy, and the other brother who becomes a glamorous, very rich gangster. Mm. So it's a way of working out what does it mean to be an American during a very, very volatile decade.
Now let's listen to a clip from early in the film which deals precisely with that. Cagney playing the Tommy character, as you say here, the gangster side of the equation. His brother Mike, played by Donald Cook.
Fine. While we're on the subject, I wish you'd try to stay home a little more.
I gotta work, ain't I?
Oh, sure. Listen, Tom, I was in a place today and I heard somebody say something.
Well, what of it?
Well, they were saying... But it seems as though they were pointing a finger at you and Matt.
Who was? What, Roger said anything about me?
Now, take it easy.
You're always hearing things. You'll get too much in your nose someday and you wonder how you got it.
Well, for crying out loud. I heard a couple of guys talking about you. As much as to say you were in on some crooked work. What am I supposed to do, run?
Well, you ain't asking me. You're telling me. And I don't know a thing, see?
All I've got to say, Tom, is that you've got a good job now. You don't need these rats you're running around with.
Well, I suppose you want me to go to night school and read poems. I've been hearing a few things myself.
There's nothing to hear about me.
That's all you know. You ain't so smart. Books and all that stuff don't hide everything.
You're a liar, Tom. You're covering up.
Covering up? For what? For you? Oh, you're nothing but a sneak thief.
What did you say?
You heard me. A petty larceny sneak thief. A nickel snatcher. Robbing a streetcar company.
And it's not Tommy who throws the punch at the end of that clip. It's brother Mike, played by Donald Cook, who knocks Jimmy Cagney's character of Tommy down to the ground. And just before we move off The Public Enemy, Tony Tracy, important to point out that this was actually based on a real life character.
Yeah, Tommy Dugan. And what was happening during this period, as I'm sure you're aware, is that there was a great scramble for sound stories, for stories with dialogue in them. And one of the, you know, chief places to go for those was gangster films and gangster, real life gangster stories. And a lot of those journalists moved west in order to become screenwriters. So the screenwriters of this film were, in fact, journalists. They had written it as a novel, which was never published, in fact, and took it west. And the other thing to say is that this is at the, you know, just in the aftermath of Al Capone. So all of that stuff has just kind of finished.
Yeah.
They're already a period kind of a film, but it really, I think, depends upon the fact that they're written by journalists and they're looking for this dialogue. And you can hear in that clip, he's so natural. He's really, really got this street rhythm that the other actor doesn't yet have.
Yeah, and Inches with Dirty Faces, we should mention just in passing, because we're talking about childhood friends here that you know played together on the streets, and then it all goes haywire.
It's a great clip in that film. Yeah, exactly. Let's Say a Prayer for the Guy Who Couldn't Run as Fast as Me, and that's with Pat O'Brien. And again, it's this Cain Abel good guy, bad guy, and very famously, of course, that's got to do with the fact that he gets electrocuted in the final scene. But that's a really fabulous film.
Yeah, I was watching that final scene today. You know, and it's the priest is begging him, please, will you just pretend that you're afraid of dying, and then we see in shadow him screaming and crying as he's about to be put in the electric chair. But there's great ambiguity as to whether he's doing that for the priest character or whether he really is afraid. It's a wonderful piece of double play.
And the thing I have to say, Sean, is that when you watch Cagney, and I've watched a fair bit of it, you know, often the stories are a little bit pat, but Cagney injects life and energy and utter credibility into every scene. He elevates every film above the often quite moralistic or, you know, rather pat narrative. And that's one of the most famous examples. And of course, he talks about later in his life, kids used to come up and say, did you turn yellow? Rocky became a kind of a signature role from at the end of the 30s there.
Yeah, you did say that he started off as a hoofer, and it's hardly surprising then that we get a little bit of this from him.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, Yankee Doodle do or die, a real live nephew of my Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July. I've got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart, she's my Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride the ponies. I am that Yankee Doodle boy.
He's a Yankee Doodle dandy, a Yankee Doodle do or die, a real life nephew of his Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July.
There he is doing a bit of singing, and he goes into a big dance routine after that.
Amazing.
A lengthy dance routine, it has to be said, Tony Tracy, that Jimmy Cagney we're talking about here.
Yeah, and by the way, we have to call him Jim Cagney. He hated being referred to as Jimmy. That was just studio invention.
James.
Yeah, no, exactly, James. He always saw himself as a hoofer, as a song and dance man. He hated being cast as a gangster. He walked away from his contract in Warner Brothers several times because he wanted artistic control. And this came at the end of the 30s. He had made a lot of money. He'd walked out of his contract several times in order to make a lot of money. He had some trouble. He had been pegged as a communist because he had become contribution to various funds. Also, his films were seen as sort of left wing in their instincts. And partly he wanted to do this film to clarify and clear up that kind of reputation. But most importantly, he wanted to do it because he was going to take a percentage of the back end. And he made $1 million out of this film. He is stupendously good. George M. Cohan was also 3/4 Irish. He could identify with that role. He learned how to dance like this extraordinary man, Cohan, who really sort of linked the vaudeville and theatre eras. And the film is quite long and goes through a lot of these classic song and dances that Cohen wrote, and this very unique dance style called Buck and Wing.
Yeah.
And really, Warners wanted to make it as a kind of a rabble-rousing patriot pro-American war film, even though it's set in a previous era.
Yeah, and lots of rides with Warners, as you say, throughout the era as well, throughout the period as well. 1949 was a kind of a comeback, though, for him in that respect. And this is the one with the mother-son relationship, rather, that you could never forget.
Well, so as I said, many of his characters were Irish American throughout the 30s. Yankee Doodle, also Irish American. By the time he had gotten out of the Warner Brothers contract with, as you say, Yankee Doodle Dandy, he had made a lot of money. He walked away and he had very poor luck trying to make independent films, non-genre films. He said, I came back to do White Heat for a five-letter word beginning with M and ending with Y. But it's interesting, this film. It's not a gangster film, although it's often called one. It's really a film noir about an outlaw called Cody Jarrett, who's psychotic. It's interesting that Cagney's not Irish any longer, so those earlier tensions and debates are not there, although the violence is there. And the character is really a Freudian kind of psychopath. Yeah. And that's really where the emphasis lies in the film. And it's a stunning film. It's the last gangster film made by Warner Brothers, and it's the last gangster film he makes some 20 years after The Public Enemy.
Let's listen to a clip between Mad Jarrett, played by Margaret Wycherley, and the character of Cody, played by Cagney.
It's these mountains, Cody. It's not good for you. Cold all the time. You can't breathe there. Let's get out, son.
It's going.
Oh. It's going?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah. It's like having a red-hot buzzsaw inside my head.
No, not yet, son.
Hmm?
Don't let them see you like that. Might give some of them ideas.
Hmm. Always thinking about your Cody, aren't you?
That's right. Top of the world, son.
Don't know what I'd do without you, Ma.
Better?
Yeah.
Now go on out. Show them you're all right.
James Cagney and Margaret Ritchie there in a scene from White Heat. Before we go, they'll all be saying, they didn't mention Dirty Rat yet. Well, I'll let James Cagney answer that. This is from his acceptance speech for the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award in 1974.
Just in passing, I never said, you dirty rat. What I actually did say was, Judy.
Well, you didn't quite say that either, James. Clarify for us what that constant misquote of James Cagney's is, if you would, Tony Tracy.
Well, as we saw in one of the earlier clips, he says rat all the time. So it was a version of that. There's two or three different versions from different films that he said. It was taken up as an impersonation. But the thing was, Cagney had retired by 61, and Cagney was more impersonated and more known from his impersonations throughout the 60s. He actually retired very, very early because he had made all his money. And that really perpetuated myth of what he had actually said.
Yeah, he said Yellow Belly Rat at some point in
Yellow
Taxi.
Belly Rat, in Taxi. Sure. That's a great film where he speaks Yiddish on the street.
Okay, listen, lots to talk about and thanks for elucidating us there on three of the films that we might start of Public Enemy, Yankee Doodle Dandy and White Heat. Tony Tracy speaking to us about James Cagney, and that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Ola McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.